Well, interestingly enough, the most important change for global real estate has nothing to do with global real estate, really. It has everything to do with the opportunities elsewhere. You're in a market now where the S&P 500 trades north of 24 times earnings. That's a big difference from where it was last year, which was a big difference from where it was the year before. And anyone who's managed money through a cycle knows that multiples don't expand forever. The opportunity cost of not diversifying into real estate or having some real estate in your portfolio has risen enormously because of the expanded multiples that lots of other things trade at, namely technology.
For most of the last few years, real estate has lived in the penalty box. Rising rates, falling valuations, and a steady drumbeat of skepticism pushed the asset class out of favor, even as the underlying buildings, tenants, and cash flows kept doing their jobs. But something interesting happened along the way. Occupancies tightened, supply dried up, rents kept rising, central banks pivoted, and quietly, global real estate started delivering again, not because the headlines changed, but because the fundamentals never really broke. Today's conversation is about that disconnect. What happens when markets price in pessimism, but reality tells a more resilient story? Where are the real risks, and where might investors be missing opportunity by looking in the rearview mirror? To help us unpack that, I'm joined by Dennis Mitchell, Chief Executive Officer and Chief Investment Officer at Starlight Capital. Dennis has spent decades navigating real estate across cycles, regions, and regimes, and his latest global outlook offers a grounded, data-driven view of what's actually driving returns today and what may matter most going forward. This isn't a call to chase a trade. It's a conversation about fundamentals, discipline, and what the next chapter for global real estate might look like once the noise fades and the signal comes back into focus. Let's get into it.
This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Dennis, welcome. It is great to have you.
Oh, thank you for the invitation. Looking forward to the discussion.
Thank you again. So, Dennis, it has been quite a year so far. I mean, a lot of noise, geopolitics, steepening yield curve, market volatility, you name it. What's your take on that?
Well, I think this is the reality that we live in for at least another 3 years. You're going to have a lot of those factors fluctuate almost on a daily basis, whether it's global trade, geopolitical announcements, transactions, and then, you know, equity markets and bond markets and currency markets were all volatile to begin with. But when you amp up the volatility from those external factors, it becomes challenging for a long-term investor to maintain a long-term strategic view.
There's a lot of wait and see going on right now. Speaking of real estate, Dennis, when you look across global real estate today, what stands out to you as the most important change from where markets were a year or two ago?
Well, interestingly enough, the most important change for global real estate has nothing to do with global real estate, really. It has everything to do with the opportunities elsewhere. You're in a market now where the S&P 500 trades north of 24 times earnings. That's a big difference from where it was last year, which was a big difference from where it was the year before. And anyone who's managed money through a cycle knows that multiples don't expand forever. The opportunity cost of not diversifying into real estate or having some real estate in your portfolio has risen enormously because of the expanded multiples that lots of other things trade at, namely technology. And one other point that I'll make is that passive investing has become a real challenge in that, you've seen the management fees for a lot of these passive index strategies plummet so low, they look super enticing to the average retail investor. But you have to recognize that you're not getting the level of diversification that you would have previously. I'm old enough to remember when Nortel was 34% of the TSX. Well, now we find ourselves in a situation where seven companies, the Mag 7, make up north of 30% of the S&P 500. So the level of concentration combined with the amount of passive capital investing in these you know, in these diversified or less than diversified index funds means that if something breaks somewhere, it's not just a small group of people who are impacted or a small group of stock. It's 30%+ of the index that's impacted and trillions of dollars of capital that is now lost. So I think that's another thing that's changed year over year that isn't necessarily global real estate, but certainly has an impact and by default makes global real estate that much more interesting and attractive because it's just not trading at these extended multiples and certainly is, you know, exposed to factors that are different from, say, global software firms.
Right. I mean, you make an interesting point. I think, you know, like investors have had the benefit of so many, you know, such a long period of time of being able to, you know, get returns from the stock market, from the S&P 500 over the last 10 years at very low cost and certainly, you know, passive without any skill involved. Part of what's going on is rotation. Investors are looking at the market and saying, you know, this can't possibly go on forever. But at the same time, it's been very hard for investors to let go of it, right? So there's this push and pull happening to diversify. One is expensive, which is the market, the stock market. The other is the bond market, which is not doing, it's not really pulling its weight as a ballast.
Yeah, we've seen a significant positive correlation between bond markets and equity markets that historically has not been the case. And to the point that you made earlier about making so much money without skill, you know, there's the old saying, you know, if it was that easy, we'd all be rich. So it stands to reason that something is going to happen somewhere that interrupts what we've seen is a smooth glide path to 20% annual compounding. And when that does happen, it'll be a question of, are investors protected in their portfolio by having some exposure to something that isn't positively correlated to, you know, the index, the passive index that they've allocated to, or the concentrated bet that they've made on software stocks. And I think real estate has shown itself time and time again to be, you know, a safe, consistent compounder of capital when used and allocated to properly.
That's only part of the call, right? I mean, the other half of the call is the fundamentals. What's behind the choice of diversification that you make today? Right. And so in global real estate, your outlook highlights strong fundamentals despite a slower global growth backdrop. How do you think investors should reconcile these two forces?
Well, I think when people think of real estate, they immediately gravitate towards, well, where are interest rates? If interest rates are coming down, then real estate will probably do well. But if you take a step back, interest rates are like gravity. You know, if you talk to any physicist, they're always, you know, interested in gravity because it's such a universal concept. So are interest rates. And so, interestingly enough, if interest rates are going down, that's good for every single risky asset everywhere. Right. So real estate might be, you know, advantaged in that scenario, but everything's going to do well. And the reverse is also true. What matters fundamentally for real estate is supply and demand. And so it's not so much interest rates going up that destroys real estate returns and values so much as it's supply and demand. And when you have a scenario where there's a tremendous amount of supply and there's a hiccup or even a slowdown in demand, you get into a situation where oversupply leads to rising vacancies. It undercuts your ability to charge rising rents. That has a negative impact on cash flow. And that is what leads to the decline in value for real estate. So coming back to the question you asked, right now, fundamentals in the real estate space are very strong because what you're seeing across the board is resilient and in some sectors, rapidly expanding demand met with a significant decline in supply over the last several years. And so whether it's data centers or industrial or, of course, seniors housing, which probably has the best fundamentals globally right now, you're seeing across real estate and across the underlying subsectors, resilient rising demand and a limited supply that leads to a situation where you have high occupancies, which gives you the ability to raise rents, which leads to rising cash flow, which increases the value of the real estate equities that trade on the markets.
What are you seeing right now? What are some of the key areas that you're really focused on? Why are those dynamics so central to your thesis right now?
Yeah, and I guess what we're seeing again is, and maybe I'll talk specifics on a sector, seniors housing. I called it out as sort of the best fundamentals globally.
Yeah, please do.
Really, yeah, what we really like about seniors housing is that regardless of whether GDP growth is plus 2% or minus 2%, we're all aging. And as we get older, you know, as we get into our 70s and certainly into our 80s, more and more of us are opting for seniors housing. Even segments of the population where culturally it's expected that, you know, the sandwich generation will look after the, you know, the older generation while they're raising the younger generation. You're seeing the likelihood or the predisposition for using seniors housing increase. So, you know, the rule of thumb we always use is 10% of people over 70 opt into seniors housing. Well, as the population ages, and in Canada, the 70 plus population is set to double by 2035, that creates a tremendous demand for more seniors housing. So I think the numbers work out to we need by 2035, another 200,000 seniors housing units in Canada. Well, there hasn't been a decade in this country where we've built more than 73,000. So you're in a scenario where we have a huge deficit and rising, you know, inexorably rising demand that is not economically dependent. And against that, you have a supply scenario that continues to lag. So that gap between supply and demand is getting wider and wider every year. And that's what allows the seniors housing operators to charge higher rents and generate higher cash flows. So that's a perfect example of, it really doesn't matter if GDP growth is +2, +4, -2, -4. You know, every day that goes by, more and more people are a day older, a year older, and the demand for seniors housing continues to march higher inexorably.
The drivers are completely different. Why the disconnect? What do you ascribe to that? What do you think is the reason? What's the main reason why we have this misperception of this opportunity?
So Warren Buffett and Benjamin Graham used to always say, if you were only allowed to make 20 stock trades for your whole career, your whole life, how much longer would you take to make every single investment? And how much more diligence would you do? Well, in the publicly traded markets, you have so much liquidity every second of every trading day that if you've made a mistake, you can erase it almost immediately. And the cost is negligible, right? You know, you have people complaining that they have to pay 99 cents for a trade now and it's free at some places. But that, you know, in terms of friction cost getting in and out is de minimis. Now, you compare that to the private market, you know, liquidity is not nearly as prompt. And the friction costs in terms of commissions and legal fees and accounting fees are a significant portion of the transaction cost. So the care and diligence that you have to take on the private side is significantly higher because of that. And transactions take much longer and the cost of transacting is much higher. So that is a huge differential in terms of the amount of diligence that goes into investing. And as a result, on the private side, there tends to be a longer sort of term, hold period, right? And a longer sort of investment process, if you will. You know, if you're, and I mean, anyone who's bought a home understands this. You know, if you buy a home, you're paying, you know, probably 4.5% to 5% commission on both sides. And, you know, you put your down payment down and you've got your property taxes and everything. If you then went and turned around and sold that house, you'd be out all the transaction costs. You certainly probably couldn't sell it for more than you just purchased it for. Whereas in the stock market, you know, you can buy a stock for $30 and sell it 20 seconds later for $32, you know, so the friction costs just don't impact the liquidity and you can have a shorter decision-making. You can have a shorter investment horizon without, you know, the friction costs of getting in and out. But I would say this, the pricing discrepancies are going to close up because in North America, going back to 2019, we've seen 10 real estate privatizations, you know, 8 per year in the United States and 2 per year in Canada. And it's large private equity, sovereign wealth funds, pension plans that are requiring these publicly traded equities that are trading at huge discounts to their net asset value. That's going to continue as long as quality real estate is trading at a discount to net asset value. So sooner or later, the valuation gap will close. Most likely, private assets will probably moderate a little bit and public assets will appreciate. But that creates an opportunity for real estate investors who take the time and have the expertise to do the diligence and allocate capital accordingly.
Yeah. And so when, I mean, in the current period, they're trading at some discount to net asset value. But when they recover to their mean asset value, assets don't just recover to their mean asset value. They tend to recover and then exceed and trade at a premium to their net asset value when the momentum occurs in the market. So you're not looking at just a reversion to mean, you're looking at a future value that has the potential to be asymmetric.
Yeah, I would say that's possible. What I would say is that if valuation gaps close because we continue to get M&A activity, then there is a good chance that you will overshoot to the upside. If for no other reason, then scarcity will start to take place, right? I mean, investors who are looking for income, investors who are looking for tax-efficient income, or specialist investors like ourselves who are locked into a real estate mandate, as we lose more and more quality companies, more of our capital moves into the remaining quality companies. And that creates the scenario you talked about where valuations may recover to their long-term historical sort of premium to net asset value and then exceed that. They've certainly undershot, right? Like we've gone through a recent period where publicly traded real estate in North America has traded at as much as 30% discounts to net asset value. It's entirely possible that they overshoot in a recovery, especially if that recovery is fueled by continued M&A.
Dennis, you've got the boots on the ground when it comes to this stuff. And you can see firsthand what the dynamics are that are driving the supply and demand situation, like, the seniors housing, for example. That there's going to be a permanent shortage there. And a permanent shortage is something that likely puts a smile on your face, right?
to a certain degree.
Yeah.
I mean, quite honestly, at some point, large pools of capital will step into the market and you'll start to see some deliveries.
Right. Right.
What I would say is that we are in the scenario right now and for the foreseeable future where you're going to have significant gaps between what is demanded and what can be supplied. Again, if you're building an independent living or assisted living or a long-term care facility, that's not an asset that gets built, in 3 or 4 months. There's an entire sort of planning and zoning and permitting process for both. But on top of that, for long-term care, there's also a licensing process that comes before any of that. So there's an extended planning cycle before you actually get to the construction cycle that takes you, into the several years realm. So for anybody who's worried about sort of a sudden increase in supply that erodes the fundamentals in this industry and real estate as a whole, there's probably 2 or 3 years of visibility where we're going to continue to enjoy significant demand and very little supply to interrupt what are strong fundamentals for global real estate.
Right. Now, valuations, Dennis, they remain well below historical norms in many regions. How do you think about the role of valuation versus fundamentals driving returns from here?
When you look at any risky asset, there are 3 sources of return, right? This goes for bonds, stocks, GICs, it doesn't matter. They are yield, growth, and multiple. And so when we look at real estate right now, quality real estate globally is offering you anywhere from 4 to say 6% in consistent yields. Could be paid semi-annually, quarterly, even monthly as Canadian REITs pay out. Then you move to what's the growth that these real estate equities can consistently generate. And so right now, again, across the globe, you're looking at anywhere from 3 to 7% internal growth being generated by these real estate names, the quality ones. So just when you look at those 2 buckets, yield and growth, you're near double-digit returns. But then you start looking at sort of what has happened with multiples and what could happen in a mean reversion scenario. And, when you look across the globe, we see the potential for double-digit returns just from multiples returning back to their long-term averages. So whether that's the discount to NAV correcting or the price to funds from operation increasing back to the long-term averages. So when you put it all together, real estate offers a very attractive, very predictable sort of double-digit total return, underscored by the fact that they pay out 4 to 5% in tax-efficient cash flow every year. We think given where broader markets are trading and how they're concentrated, you're going to start to see capital move to real estate as a defensive hedge against a very concentrated, very expensive, broader equity market, but also as the population globally ages, more and more of them become income investors who actually need the income to fund their retirements. So you have two twin engines driving sort of valuations and returns in the real estate space. At some point, the market's going to recognize that.
There's the driver that you know, the portfolio construction driver, which is I need to diversify my portfolio. And then there's the fundamental driver, which is this is a good area to fund to diversify my portfolio into, right? So that's the double whammy, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, if you're overweight technology, which I think a lot of investors are, and if you're concentrated in some of these passive strategies that by extension are also very concentrated in technology, then again, you're going to want to be looking for other sectors that are exposed to different drivers. And the more resilient and economically independent those drivers are, the better. And so the demographic story of seniors housing is a great one. But when we talk, you know, everyone's excited about AI, right? And I always make sort of the picks and shovels analogy in that lots of people went to San Francisco in 1949 to pan for gold and find their riches, but more people made money selling picks and shovels and panning and equipment and mules than did people get rich from actually finding gold. And so, you know, I to make the analogy to real estate, you know, if you're excited about AI, then buy cell tower REITs and buy data center REITs. They're both exceptionally cheap and they offer exposure and leverage to the infrastructure of AI, right? You know, North Americans spend on average 7 hours connected to the internet every day. 92% of that connection is via their smartphone. Those smartphones are connected to cell tower networks, accessing apps and data that is stored on the servers and data centers. So if you're excited about AI, you should be excited about cell tower REITs and data center REITs. That's another example.
Dennis, as we move through 2026, what are you going to be watching most closely to validate or challenge your outlook for global real estate?
Yeah, I come back to the opportunity cost. I think the volatility in the markets will raise people's perceptions of risk. I think investors will start to look at sort of where multiples are compared to their long-term average. And I think that discussion about diversification will start to become more and more prevalent and more urgent, if you will. And at that point, I'll be looking at fund flows, right? How much capital is now moving into real estate? And the more capital that moves into real estate, on all else being equal, the more you'll start to see those valuations start to creep up. You'll start to see the discounts to NAV start to disappear. And when that happens, we'll know that real estate's in favor again and that investors are recognizing the value. And, you know, the catalyst for that is the continued M&A activity. You know, at some point, you know, as investors start to lose REITs that they used to own that they really liked, they'll start to realize that other people have found these REITs and like them so much that they're not content to just buy units or shares of them. They want the whole thing. So I'll be monitoring fund flows and I'll be monitoring M&A activity because I think those are the two catalysts that will drive a recovery in real estate valuations and ultimately returns in the short term.
Wonderful. Dennis, thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time. That was a fascinating look at global real estate, especially at a time when investors really haven't been focused all that much on it. But Dennis, thank you so much. It's been great having you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the invitation and happy to join you again in a year's time.
We'll look forward to that.